Hi friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is July 27, 1978, and this is my audio letter number 36. For three generations, the Rockefeller dynasty has been a dominant factor in the economic, political, and social life of America. And for three decades, four Rockefeller brothers of the third generation, David, Nelson, Lawrence, and John D. III, have been the real rulers of the Western world. Long ago, they carved up the world into spheres of influence. But by coordinating their activities and working as a unit, the four brothers have held unparalleled sway over the fate of all mankind. But 3 years ago this month, in audio letter number 2, I revealed that the brothers were beginning to lose their iron grip on events. For example, Nelson Rockefeller had been planning to replace then-President Gerald Ford in the Oval Office no later than June 1975. But Ford survived the strange illness that sent him crashing down stairs and aircraft ramps during that month. And he has had no more falling spells in the 3 years since then. A few months later, in September and October 1975, a rash of assassination attempts almost removed Ford from the scene, but those two were bungled. 2 years ago this month, in audio letter 14, I revealed that the underwater missile crisis of 1976 was underway. This crisis, which the government has never made public, was only the beginning of a total military double-cross of the Rockefellers by their secret ally, the Soviet Union. As I have made public the previous spring in audio letter 12, key trustees of the Rockefeller-controlled major foundations had already concluded that a Russian double-cross was imminent. But the brothers themselves had not agreed with that conclusion. They had grown up knowing that the Soviet Union was secretly financed and dominated by their own Rockefeller cartel. They simply could not imagine that Russia might somehow slip from their grasp. Only when a Russian hydrogen bomb was recovered from the waters of Seal Harbor, Maine, did the four brothers really believe that a military double-cross was underway. I had given its exact navigational coordinates in audio letter 15 for August 1976, and it was removed late that month by the United States Navy. This bomb was one of the topics I discussed with General George S. Brown, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in my meeting with him at the Pentagon on September 16, 1976. Once they knew that Russia truly was preparing for a surprise nuclear attack on America, the brothers could have taken steps to prevent war altogether. But that would have involved letting the public in on the truth. And as our Lord has said, the truth shall make you free. The Rockefeller brothers are not interested in your freedom and mine, but in ever more power. So they try to reinstate their alliance with the Soviets. And in order to reestablish the carefully controlled joint plan for nuclear war on American soil, the Rockefellers made tremendous concessions to appease the Kremlin. One of these concessions led to the opening of the doors for Soviet nuclear saboteurs to swarm all over the United States, planting nuclear mines, large and small, at dams, reservoirs, public buildings, manufacturing plants, grain elevators, refineries, and many other targets. For that reason, at this time last year, my audio letter was in a state of voluntary suspension. For 3 months, from late May to late August 1977, I cooperated with concerned citizens nationwide in an effort to bring about decisive exposure and official action to stop the wholesale nuclear sabotage of America. But those efforts failed, my friends, as I revealed for you last August when I resumed the audio letter with issue number 25. Through all of these events and more, the declining power and resolve of the four brothers was becoming more and more apparent. But all of these setbacks paled into insignificance beside America's disastrous defeat in space last September. In the Battle of the Harvest Moon, the secret American moon base in Copernicus crater was knocked out. Armed with powerful beam weapons able to strike any spot on Earth, the Copernicus base had been the Rockefeller's ace in the hole in the war to come, but now it was gone. This decisive space battle still has not been admitted publicly by the government, but is the real reason for the many desperate anti-Russian moves now underway by America. My friends, we are plunging into a period of confrontation diplomacy on the road to war. Nations great and small are lining up and taking sides for the great conflict to come, just as happened before World Wars I and II. At the same time, the bone-chilling winds of Bolshevik revolution are sweeping across the land, in America, in Britain, and parts of Europe. To this end, the manipulated collapse of Western monopolistic capitalism is accelerating, led by the fall of the gold-poor American dollar. The West is being thrown into the most critical period in all its history by the Rockefeller brothers. Yet this is happening as the final decline of the Rockefeller dynasty is accelerating. Last month, I pointed out the historical fact that all true dynasties have a lifespan of only about 100 years. That point has already been reached by the Rockefeller dynasty, and the Rockefeller brothers are already in the twilight of their power. And earlier this month, on July 10, 1978, the downfall of the Rockefeller brothers took a stunning new turn. John D. Rockefeller III, the eldest of the four brothers, was killed in a head-on collision as he rode in a car near the family estate in Pocantico Hills, New York. The crash was supremely ironic for reasons I will explain in topic number one. But more than that, it dealt a crippling blow to the unit comprised by the four brothers. And it is a blow that has further increased the pressure on David, Nelson, and Lawrence to hurry up with their plans for revolution and war. My three topics for today are topic number one, the legacy of the late John D. Rockefeller III. Topic number two, the new American strategy for a first strike. And topic number three, the aftermath of Nuclear War I. Topic number one. Normally, my friends, it's in poor taste to speak negatively of those who have departed. But the automobile accident that took the life of John D. Rockefeller III did not alter the truth of what I have told you for years while he was still alive. And it did not undo terrible plans he helped to set in motion that will still affect your life and your future. John D. Rockefeller III was one of the most powerful men on earth. The controlled major media have covered up the true significance of his life and death. But I believe you have a right to know. Long ago, public relations experts outfitted him with the public image he wore for the rest of his life, that of a kindly, shy philanthropist. Even in death, this image is being carefully preserved through public relations stories about his funeral in the controlled major media. It was John, we are told, who delighted most in giving away the family fortune and who devoted his life to this task. But, my friends, the fact is that John played an indispensable role in expanding the Rockefeller Empire, coordinating his activities with those of his brothers. Of the four brothers, it was John who specialized in several areas that are now of crucial importance to you. One area was that of the Rockefeller-controlled foundations, whose philanthropic halo has little to do with their true nature. Another area was Asia, especially Japan. A third area was that of Africa. And a fourth focus of John's was his so-called Second American Revolution, which is now degenerating into a new Bolshevik Revolution here in America. As the 20th century was dawning nearly eight decades ago, John D. Rockefeller Sr. was launching the first of his tax-exempt foundations. It was called the General Education Board. In 1904, the board issued its first publication called Occasional Letter No. 1 by John D. Rockefeller Sr. and his shrewd assistant, Reverend Frederick Taylor Gates. This document, for which I quoted over 2 years ago in Audio Letter 10, made clear the true purpose of the board. This objective was nothing less than to completely remake society according to Rockefeller blueprints. The same purpose has continued to motivate every foundation in the Rockefeller orbit since then, but each foundation specializes on some particular aspect of this overriding goal. In establishing one foundation after another, John D. Rockefeller Sr. coordinated his actions from the outset with Andrew Carnegie, who was doing the same thing. In this way, they avoided duplication and increased the scope of their joint efforts. In the area of so-called philanthropies, the Rockefeller and Carnegie interests were intertwined, and gradually they all came completely under the Rockefeller umbrella. But on January 26, 1917, Senator Chamberlain of Oregon rose to give a warning on the floor of the United States Senate. He said, quote, "The Carnegie-Rockefeller influence is bad. In two generations, they can change the minds of the people to make them conform to the cult of Rockefeller or the cult of Carnegie, rather than to the fundamental principles of American democracy." Unquote. Today, it is two generations later, and we hear no more warnings like this in Congress. The prophetic warning of Senator Chamberlain has come true. The Rockefeller-Carnegie conglomerate of foundations long ago unleashed evil forces directed at education, at government, at the very fabric of society. And for nearly four decades, beginning in 1931, it was John D. Rockefeller III who, of the four brothers, served as custodian of these evil forces. Starting with his trusteeship of the General Education Board and the Rockefeller Foundation, he extended his influence throughout the dynasty's foundation network, which he also enlarged. But now the evil forces unleashed so long ago are out of control. John D. Rockefeller III's coordination of foundations on behalf of his three brothers and himself has now led to double cross and the commitment for a one-world government and nuclear war to come. Another area of attention became a preoccupation of John D. III even before the foundations, and that was Asia. It began in 1929, when as a fresh college graduate he traveled to Kyoto, Japan, under the sponsorship of the Rockefeller-controlled Institute of Pacific Relations, or IPR. During the 1930s, the number one priority of the IPR was to maneuver Japan into attacking the United States under conditions that would serve Rockefeller interests. John D. III threw himself eagerly into this work and greatly expanded Rockefeller activity in Asia through other avenues as well. It was he who supervised the preparations of the Rockefeller Empire to take advantage of coming events in Asia. The IPR spawned the infamous Richard Sorge spy ring with headquarters at Lee, Massachusetts. After the war, congressional investigations proved that it was the Sorge ring that brought about the Pearl Harbor attack. Guided by information from the IPR spy ring, Franklin Delano Roosevelt made all the necessary preparations to ensure that the desired Pearl Harbor attack would backfire on the Japanese. 2 months ago in Audio Letter 34, I explained the master strategy behind all this. Most members of the public at large had no idea that war with Japan was imminent, because the government did not want us to know. Perhaps the only clear public warning was that heard on November 9, 1941, by the Congregation of Christ Church in Alexandria, Virginia. The rector, Bishop Wells, had heard the news only 3 days earlier from Norman Davis, then president of the American Red Cross, as I told you in detail in Audio Letter 22. Davis was very close to FDR and told Bishop Wells that war with Japan would erupt within 5 weeks. Bishop Wells, shaken by this news, immediately alerted his congregation. 4 weeks later, the Pearl Harbor attack took place. When war broke out, John D. Rockefeller III promptly made himself assistant, quote-unquote, to the same Norman Davis, who had told Bishop Wells of the coming war with Japan. From there, John moved from one position to another, setting the stage for a complete Rockefeller takeover of Japan after the war. As soon as World War II ended, John D. Rockefeller III and his entourage swooped down upon the ruins of Japan. To a people destitute in the aftermath of war, financial resources of Rockefeller proportions can buy almost anything and everything, and they did just that. Soon, the mammoth Rockefeller cartel of thousands of Japanese enterprises, the Zaibatsu, began emerging. Much of the early industrial rebirth in Japan under Rockefeller control was in the area of electronics, for which the Japanese have an enormous aptitude. One of the most famous Rockefeller enterprises in Japan in this realm is that of Sony, whose products have penetrated every nook and cranny of the world. Sony, my friends, is not a Japanese name or word, but an acronym. It stands for the former Standard Oil of New York. Today, Japan is making a bid to become the number one power in electronics in the entire world. At the funeral of John D. Rockefeller III this month, more than half of the cables and telegrams came from associates in Japan. But John's expertise in the Far East went far beyond Japan to include all of Asia. Today, as the United States is trying to play the so-called China card against Russia, Japan is being pushed into Red Chinese arms to assist in this desperate strategy. But the fact is that Red China has no intention of establishing a real alliance with the United States against Russia. Instead, China is playing the America card, knowing that Russia is now the foremost military power on Earth. The Chinese hope by their current strategy to extract the best possible terms later as the price of a restored alliance with Russia. Japan, too, squeezed between East and West, is trying to follow a course that is not at all what the Rockefeller brothers meant to accomplish. With very active treaty bargaining underway now between Red China and Japan, China has been trying to include a clause against regional domination by a single power, a clause which is considered anti-Russian by the Kremlin. Moscow has singled out this one clause as its only objection to a Sino-Japanese treaty. And now, Japan has decided to insist on including an auxiliary clause that clearly states that the regional domination clause is not directed against any specified third power. In this way, Japan hopes to satisfy both Russia and China. In this way, Japan is becoming the pivot point for the giant new Asian axes I first warned about 5 years ago in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. And so the legacy of John D. Rockefeller III lives on after him in the Far East. After 5 decades of destructive meddling in Asian affairs, he has suddenly left the scene just when his brothers need him most. In Asia as elsewhere, the brothers are losing control. And with John gone, this trend will start accelerating. 3 decades ago, the Rockefeller dynasty was only beginning to cash in on the takeover of Japan by means of World War II. But already John D. III was looking around hungrily for the next great prize to devour. He found what he was looking for in Africa. In the early fall of 1948, John D. III took a 2-month trip to Africa under the auspices of the Rockefeller Foundation. He returned bubbling over about the unparalleled natural resources of Africa and the great commercial and industrial potential of the continent. In an interview with the New York Times on November 14, 1948, he explained his trip as having been motivated by great concern over the health and welfare of the natives. But his true preoccupation was economic, and was so strong that he almost gave it all away during the interview. Time and again, his public relations counselor had to bring him back to the supposed subject of native welfare so that the New York Times would have something to quote on that topic. As always, the strategy of Rockefeller takeover in Africa was to involve turmoil and bloodshed. Africa's troubles really began after John's trip there 30 years ago. It was not long until he publicly revealed what lay ahead for Africa in a speech on January 18, 1951. He said, quote, "It will not be many years before the same kind of upheaval now appearing in Asia will be witnessed in Africa," unquote. And he was true to his word. Soon, words like Mau Mau entered the language of a horrified world as incidents of interracial butchery and terrorism began to multiply. European colonial holdings in Africa began to disintegrate. New nations sprung up in their places with nominally black governments. But in every case, the new black governments found it necessary to bring back the white man to manage and develop the economic resources. And Rockefeller multinational corporations swooped down and took over established mining and other activities with virtual freedom from effective local government interference. Until recently, the Rockefeller inroads into Africa were being accomplished in secret alliance with the Soviet Union. But since the Battle of the Harvest Moon 10 months ago, all this has changed. Under the former joint Rockefeller-Soviet plans, there was no hope for survival of southern Africa. The Rockefeller brothers and their then Russian allies were bent on complete domination in Africa and elsewhere. But the type of domination sought by the Kremlin today is far different in character. As a result, if southern Africa can hold out against the buffeting that has already been set in motion, there is now a new ray of hope that did not exist before. At the present time, Rhodesia is on the front lines, and fighting is underway now near Salisbury, the capital. 2 guerrilla forces are involved. 1 under Robert Mugabe is based primarily in Mozambique and is Soviet-sponsored. The other, under Joshua Nkomo, is based in Zambia and is Rockefeller-sponsored. And just as the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance has been terminated elsewhere, it is a thing of the past in Africa. This month, 15 of Mugabe's officers were recruited away from him by Nkomo with large amounts of Rockefeller money. By the same token, Nkomo has just executed a high-ranking officer in his ranks for being pro-Russian. Increasingly, the Mugabe and Nkomo factions will be fighting each other as proxies of Russia and the United States. Each would race to beat the other to try to take over Rhodesia. Ultimately, the legacy of John D. Rockefeller III in Africa will be a complete failure, with Russia picking up what is left of the Rockefeller chips. Africa, like the rest of the world, will be forced to make its peace with Russia. But the domination of Africa by the new breed in the Kremlin today promises to be less drastic and destructive than what would have taken place under the Rockefeller corporate socialist dictatorship. The manner in which John D. Rockefeller III met his death was supremely ironic in view of his role in the ravaging of Africa. The chief Rockefeller agent in Zambia today in the war against southern Africa is United States Ambassador Stephen Lowe. It was his nephew, 16-year-old David Lowe, who died along with John D. Rockefeller III when their cars crashed head-on, July 10, 1978. There remains one more critical realm in which the legacy of John D. Rockefeller III must be mentioned. I refer to his so-called Second American Revolution, which is now being transformed into a Bolshevik revolution here in America. 3 years ago, this month, in audio book talking tape number 4, I exposed the secret new Constitution for America that had been written for the Rockefeller brothers. The product of 10 years, 100 participants, 40 drafts, and many millions of dollars, the secret new Constitution was completed in 1974 by a Rockefeller tax-exempt foundation. The secret Rockefeller Constitution is a parody of what our forefathers created in 1787, using high-sounding phrases. It is a blueprint for a complete corporate socialist dictatorship. The propaganda campaign to set the stage for acceptance of the secret new Constitution was the responsibility of John D. Rockefeller III. In 1973, he published a book entitled The Second American Revolution, and articles and interviews on the subject followed. Then on March 31, 1975, a full-page ad entitled A Bicentennial Declaration appeared in the New York Times. The ad was sponsored by John's so-called National Committee for the Bicentennial Era and paid for by Rockefeller Corporations. It was repeated in other publications nationwide and was intended to be an echo of the Communist Manifesto as a starting gun for change. That campaign fizzled in its original form, but all the machinery of revolution is being cranked up again now. This time the goal is a Bolshevik revolution here in the United States with the Rockefeller brothers in the driver's seat. In audio letter 14, 2 years ago this month, I mentioned a very important lesson the four brothers learned from their sponsorship of Adolf Hitler, explaining the success of the Nazi revolution from the vantage point of 1936. Hitler said, quote, "It is not enough to overthrow the old state, but that the new state must previously have been built up and be practically ready to one's hand," unquote. That is why, as I revealed last December 1977, in audio letter 29, governmental positions at all levels in the United States are fast being packed with Bolsheviks, many of them recently expelled from Soviet Russia. When the revolution takes place soon, they will be in a position to take over, under the leadership of Nelson Rockefeller, of course. Economically, the first winds of revolution are already stirring across the land. Strikes in key industries and public services are becoming rampant, and as the cutting edge of the Bolshevik Revolution, the so-called taxpayers' revolt is already underway. Americans have forgotten that it was the cry of down with taxes, no taxes, that the Bolsheviks used in 1917 to help seduce the Russian people. So cleverly is this being done now that it has been portrayed as a conservative cause, and Americans are on the verge of stampeding to their own slaughter. My friends, earlier this month, John D. Rockefeller III was killed in a head-on collision on a highway. But his surviving three brothers are driving our entire nation toward a fatal head-on collision with the Soviet Union. In a harshly worded article in Pravda only 12 days ago, Russia warned the West that we are now riding, quote, "a tide that is carrying those who swim in it toward the cliffs of confrontation," unquote.